on topics ranging from becoming an MC to healthy living to information on going to Africa. That evening, the summit will close with a youth talent showcase. Again, that's the Portland Youth Summit, February 12th and 13th at the Blazers Boys and Girls Club, 5250 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kbo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Community Acupuncture and Massage, a benefit for political prisoner Mutulu Shakur, Sunday, February the 7th, noon to 4 p.m. at 7 Star Acupuncture in Portland. Dr. Mutulu Shakur was one of the founders of the Black Acupuncture Advisory Association in North America and the Harlem Institute of Acupuncture. Incarcerated for 30 years, Mutulu and his legal team are seeking community and financial support to fight his imprisonment. A group of licensed acupuncturists and massage therapists are offering treatments to our community as a fundraiser. Again, that's of Community Acupuncture and Massage, a benefit for political prisoner Mutulu Shakur, Sunday, February the 7th, noon to 4 p.m. at 7 Star Acupuncture, 436 Southeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Alafair Burke is the author of more than a dozen novels. Her newest is a thriller called The X. Alafair is also a former prosecuting attorney and teaches law at Hofstra University in Long Island, New York.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here at KBOO. I remember when you published your first novel back in the 1990s, okay, because this is Portland. At that time, you were a prosecuting attorney right here in Multnomah County. What compelled you to become a novelist?
Well, I actually started my first book after I left the district attorney's office here in Portland. I had worked for Mike Schrunk at the DA's office for the last half of the 1990s, and then I moved. And I didn't really move by choice. I followed the other half of a relationship that I was in at the time and I'm no longer in. But kind of through that relationship, I was sort of... The consequence of it was that I moved to Buffalo, New York, which was not a city I chose to live in, and I had to find a different job that I wasn't particularly happy in. And I really missed Portland, and I missed my old job, and I missed my friends, and I had always wanted to write a book. I shouldn't say always, but in the time that I was at the DA's office, I was also an avid reader. I'd go to Powell's on the weekends and buy used mystery paperbacks, and over the course of working at the DA's office and reading crime novels on the weekends, I started to think, you know, I live in a setting that would be really great for the genre. And I think I have things to say about criminal justice that I could say through fiction. And I had an idea for a character and a plot and a setting, but I didn't really have the energy to do it. When I was practicing law, I would come home and I would just kind of be tired and want to eat my takeout and watch Seinfeld and go to bed. But when I was wound up in this city that I didn't know anybody in and working a job I really didn't like, I thought, you know, if I don't start this book now, like, when am I ever going to do it? And writing that first book, which became Judgment Calls, set in Portland, the main character worked at the DA's office. When I would sit down with my computer at night and work on it, it was like going home. It was like visiting Portland, and I could, you know, write about Pioneer Courthouse Square, and I could write about East County, and I could kind of visit my friends in the office. And I really just did it for myself. And it's kind of shocking to me now that I've got all these books all these years later. I kind of stumbled into an amazing career. So.
Stumbled into it. If I can just stick on that book for a minute, that book was patterned on the Keith Jesperson serial murder case,
yes.
Which was a very creepy case. I don't know why it seems like there's so many serial murders in the Pacific Northwest. Maybe I'm imagining it.
No, you're not imagining it. It's kind of Florida. It's like the two corners of the country are Florida, and then the Pacific Northwest seem to have more than their fair share. But I had worked on that case at the very tail end of it. I was a very new lawyer in the office, and I had done a federal clerkship, which meant, you know, how to write, and the whole job is writing, and you have to write pretty quickly. And when that case happened, for people who aren't familiar with it, two people had already been convicted, of killing a woman named Tanya Bennett, and they had served 5 years in prison. And then along comes this guy named Keith Jesperson, who was arrested for killing his girlfriend in Vancouver, Washington. And when he realized they had him on that, he confessed not only to that murder, but to several others, including the Tanya Bennett case, which is a problem when you have two other people who have already served time for it. So the challenge was to get the two innocent people out and get the guilty guy in. And it turns out it's a lot harder to get innocent people out of prison than you would think. So they needed someone to write everything. And I became fascinated by the facts and started fictionalizing them in my head and kind of coming up with different scenarios, none of which turned out to be true, but one of which turned out to be the plot for Judgment Calls.
Okay, now, so, and this is what I have to ask you. What is it about crime? Why do I just eat it up? I love The X, you know, and I love that book. Why are we so fascinated by crime? Shouldn't we be hiding away from it? What is it about it that touches a chord in us?
That is such a good question. I think to some extent it's a feeling of closure. I think that particularly women, I mean, women are really drawn to very authentic crime fiction. And I think because, you know, women live with a constant fear of certain types of crime, I shouldn't say constant fear, but this kind of lingering thing in the background that there's a vulnerability that I think a lot of women feel, that if you see it on the page, it makes you less afraid of it in a way. And then in fiction, you always get some kind of resolution, right? The middle of the book is chaos and you think everything feels out of control. But at the end, all the pieces come together and there's some kind of closure. And I think that that's what people find satisfying. It's kind of like why you ride a roller coaster, because at the end, when you pull into the, when you pull back into the station, it's kind of like that moment of, oh, everything is peaceful again. And I almost wonder if that's what people get out of crime fiction. I also just think people are fascinated by the potential of human beings to do such terrible things. And I would say over time, as I write more books, I'm less likely to write a book about someone who's just bad because they were born bad and then they do bad things and the good guys come along and find them. My more recent books are stories about relatively normal people who are in some kind of situation and they make one bad decision or they keep one secret or they tell one lie and that triggers a consequence and then they have to deal with that consequence. And before you know it, relatively normal people can wind up doing terrible things, but it's not because they started out bad. It's this ripple effect of bad decisions. And I think The X is very much one of those kinds of stories.
In The X, Olivia Randall is a criminal defense attorney who ends up taking the case of an ex-sweetheart accused of murdering three people. What seed of thought germinated into this wild thriller is my question.
The title, The X, I think touches on the dynamic that I wanted to tap into. I think many of us, if we're being honest with ourselves, have some relationship in our past where we just don't feel right about it. It's not that we want it back. It's not the cliche of the one who got away. It's a realization that some relationship that ended didn't have to be that way, that if you could go back and know then what you know now, be a more mature, caring person, maybe you would have dealt with people differently. And I also think a lot of people identify, at least I do, with there's something surreal about 20 years after the fact, you're a total stranger to someone who was once your everything. So the main character, Olivia Randall, was engaged 20 years ago to Jack Harris. And at the time, you know, they were there for each other through everything. They lived together. When they thought of their future, it was supposed to be with each other. And now 20 years after the fact, they're complete strangers. And she still feels a lot of guilt about the kind of horrible way in which she ended that relationship, which led to really bad consequences that you learn about in the book. But she's carried all this guilt around for 20 years, and now all of a sudden he's back in this big, shocking way because he's accused of a triple murder that she's convinced he could not possibly have done. Like, good, sweet, nice Jack could never have been so horrible. So she's a criminal defense attorney now, and she agrees to represent him. And I think for her, it's a chance not only to save him, to sort of make up for past wrongs, but also make it up to herself for the things that she did in the past that she regrets.
If you just tuned in, this is Between the Covers, and we're talking with Alifair Burke about her newest mystery novel, The X. For me, this is a procedural novel. I love procedurals, where the real plot emerges from the details of how attorneys work. No spoilers. What made you decide to write this from the point of view of a defense attorney rather than a prosecutor? What are the different dynamics at play there?
Oh, that's funny. I never even thought about writing it from the perspective of she prosecutes her ex. But to be the defense attorney is really, it's a chance for her to really be there for him in a way she wasn't before. As a procedural, I think it reads as a really good thriller, I hope, because it's realistic that defense attorneys don't know everything all at once, right? It's not like the police just show up and give, with a prosecutor, you often, by the time you're making a charging decision, you pretty much know everything. Ideally, the police have done an investigation and they tell you everything. And so you kind of already have all the clues. It's just a question of what's going to happen at trial. With defense attorneys, they enter it really knowing nothing, right? They know whatever it is the defendant tells them, which may or may not be the truth. And then they get whatever it is the prosecution decides they should have in the order that they happen to get it. Some things are hidden in boxes and boxes of information. So, I think the reader learns about the case at the same pace Olivia learns about it, which is sort of a nice setup because she enters the room thinking there's no way Jack did this because she knows Jack. There's no way Jack Harris could kill people. But then as the evidence comes in, she starts to have doubts and she starts to look back at what she ever really knew about him. And I'm really fascinated by memory. Are you fascinated by memory?
There's an excellent blog called "You Are Not So Smart," and they constantly they look at research into cognition.
Yes.
And so it's not something that comes out of journalism departments, but this is a journalism blog that educates people about fact checking.
Yes.
So yes.
Yeah. So I'm really fascinated by the social science and cognition of memory, and there's something intuitive about, you know, people who think I saw it with my own eyes is the best form of proof. And of course, we know now that it's not. Memory is fragile. It changes over time. And it doesn't just change in random ways. It changes in predictable ways. And it changes with emotion. So a narcissist remembers events in a way that he remembers the moments that are all about him, or he makes it all about him. A person with depression tends to remember only the negative parts of an event. And Olivia starts to wonder if maybe all of her guilt and kind of self-loathing made her remember this relationship as she was always bad and he was always good. And she starts to replay their relationship in her head and starts to wonder if there was some dark side to Jack the whole time that she's sort of forgotten about, and that her memory is sort of morphed over time. And so she starts to see this relationship from a different side of things. So for me, I do think it's a procedural, but there's also a little bit of psychology in there that Olivia doesn't really know what to believe anymore.
You begin to doubt yourself.
Yes.
But I'm fascinated by your use of police and legal documents. In
yes.
this. How did you recreate them? Because, I mean, again, I'm a document nerd. I eat them up. And it's just, to me, that was like a candy trail, weirdly.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
It's always a challenge in crime fiction of you want to put the reader in the middle of a case without just telling them what happened. You know, part of the problem with a procedural is sometimes if it's a detective just describing what they wrote in a notebook, it can be a little bit boring. And I played with different forms when I was writing The X, and I decided to actually put transcripts, you know, kind of fake pieces of transcripts that Olivia, they're fake in real life because I made them up, but they read like real transcripts.
They read like real transcripts.
sort of the most exciting parts of real transcripts, and it's formatted differently. And I think we're at this weird time right now where people are looking, they're learning about the criminal justice system and about the legal system through entertainment. So if you think about the Serial podcasts, or currently everybody's obsessed with Netflix's Making a Murderer, those forms are journalism, but it's also through entertainment, and they're actually playing parts of trial tapes, and they're taking videos from the courtroom, and they're showing you transcripts. And as someone who likes that form, I thought you could use that in a novel just as well. And so instead of the beginning, some narrator telling the reader, Jack just got arrested, they actually see it happen in a transcript of his interview at the police precinct. He thinks he's down there as a witness, and all of a sudden they drop the bomb on him that he's a suspect, and then it says, you know, recording ended. And I hopefully that's an effective form. It's kind of unusual, I guess.
And this is what strikes me about it. As I read your new novel, I'm on this emotional roller coaster ride through the lives of really dynamic and fascinating people who are dealing with some of the deepest personal and social issues of our times, right? And there was a great interview with you recently on the Huffington Post about this. And to me, I feel as if today in the 21st century, some of these issues are harsher than when I was a kid. Maybe I'm imagining that, but I don't think so. Mass shootings, right? You put that on top of the usual failed relationships. We got legal ethics, depression, single parenting, grieving. Did you ever feel overwhelmed by these? I mean, I know that's a novelist's job, but I feel like there's something about the mass shootings, stuff like this, and your use of this procedural, these documents, there's something that feels realer. What do you think about that?
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that observation. I think if you're going to write crime fiction in a realistic way, and I think if you do write crime fiction, you owe it to yourself and other people to write about it in an honest way. The kind of books that do kind of offend me within the genre are ones that use crime merely as a plot device, you know, where victim number 17's battered body turns up in a dumpster and the killer left a note on it, and then you go to your next clue and there's no discussion of who victim number 17 is or what it was like for her to go into a dumpster. And I don't like those kinds of books, and I don't write those kinds of books, I hope. For me, I use crime as a way to write about the world, and I think if you're going to write about crime in a realistic way, you are going to wind up talking about things like race, like mass shootings, like police discretion, like wrongful convictions, and it's not meant to be a political diatribe, but it's just simply something that's happening in the world today. So I was sort of surprised when a lot of people thought it was daring somehow to have a book that has in the backdrop a mass shooting, because those happen in the world. They happen so frequently that you almost lose track of them because they start to blur together. And why wouldn't the world that are fictional characters inhabit have to live with those atrocities too? So for me, I was ready to write about that, but it's not on the page. So although there's a mass shooting that's critical to the plot of the book, it's in the past. You hear about it after the fact. The reader's not really living through it directly. The book is about the people who survive it and how it ties the families together and the repercussions of it and the toll it may have. Jack's wife was murdered 3 years ago in a mass shooting, and the question is whether that was part of his motive for what he did today. It's sort of about the repercussions of that event upon him, his daughter, or the other survivors.
All right. I wanted to shift gears a little and ask what you think about how some of your themes hit local communities and the country as a whole. Can we do that?
Is sure.
That okay? In your career as a prosecuting attorney and now a law professor, do certain themes or issues percolate up to capture your focus as you are inside that? I want to describe it as something like a fishbowl. What are your law students talking about right now?
Oh, that's a very good question. Because I teach criminal law and criminal procedure, the interactions I have with students are about those issues. So, of course, the recent Black Lives Matter movement, police uses of force, I would say, has been a big topic of discussion within the criminal justice curriculum recently. Kind of somewhat related to that, stop and frisk certainly as an issue, particularly in New York where I live, has been very much in the forefront of people's discussion. And then somewhat relatedly, self-defense cases like the Trayvon Martin cases. Who is it that we allow to claim self-defense? Whose ground can be stood, right? If you think about the cases, the things unfolding in Burns right now, do we treat all claims of police brutality equally? You know, who has the right to arm themselves? When we picture people who have the right to concealed carry, who are we really picturing? I think students are very much talking about that, the race and class and gender and how it interacts with the criminal justice system. And again, I think those are the kinds of things that you see crime fiction exploring pretty effective. There's a lot of people doing really interesting work, and I do see it as more than just entertainment. They're really exploring those themes in fiction.
We're talking with Allafair Burke. Her newest thriller is called The X. Does your experience in piecing together legal cases impact your work in piecing together these densely rendered thrillers? I mean, this is intricate. It's incredibly well woven emotionally, as well as just the process of how people are questioned by the police.
I think if you look at people who are pretty good at plotting out a crime novel or putting together a mystery, which is like a puzzle, you do start to see certain trends. I think there are people who are former lawyers who are very good at it. You know, I'm a former lawyer. Linda Fairstein and Lisa Scottolini are former lawyers and journalists, kind of long-form journalists. Michael Connelly, Laura Littman was a journalist. And I think what those two have in common is, one, they're writing a lot in their day job, so you're just flexing those muscles. So even though you're not writing fiction, it seems natural to sit down and put words on a page. But two, you have to learn how to tell a story, and you have to learn how to do it in a way that perhaps isn't the obvious way to do it. So in journalism, for example, they don't always just tell you beginning, middle, and end. You have to find a take on it, right, to make events be a story. And with lawyers, you can't tell a story beginning, middle, and end. You're forced to do it in the somewhat unnatural way of witness by witness by witness, right? Which was never how, if I sat down and told you a story at dinner, I would never do it by source of information by source of information. I would do it in some other way. And I think if you're forced to tell a story in a certain somewhat unnatural form, it actually helps you figure out how to tell a story in a creative way, if that makes sense. Because you're a somewhat boring way to tell a story is to just start at the beginning and tell everything in order. It creates more tension if you know how to play with structure. And I think being a trial attorney helped me do that.
That's completely fascinating. Now I want to shift gears a little bit more. You have a lot more going on in your life than most people do. Okay, I'm putting that up. You are a novelist. You teach law. I mean, there's plenty of people on earth who would do one or the other of those, right? I think that you're doing a mystery collaboration with another super famous author.
Yes.
I'm going to ask you about that a little later. But what do you do to unwind? I mean, what is your Sunday like?
I like to socialize, so I'm a kind of a busy bee. So even here, while I'm in Portland to talk about The X, because I lived here, I have a lot of friends. So if you look at my calendar, it's kind of radio interview, breakfast with my friend at Zell's Cafe, come to KBOO. My next stop is a friend's house for a little happy hour. Then I'm going to Pal's. So I like to see my friends. I like my dogs. I do have a lot going on in terms of work, but I think I'm the luckiest person in the world in that although I have a lot of work that has to be finished, I get to say when it's done, right? So I can work at 3 a.m. if that's when I want to work. And then if I want to take a day off and just play with my dogs, I can do that too, as long as the work gets done. And there's something freeing about that for me that helps me be efficient. And to me, they all complement each other. I basically think of myself as a writer and a teacher and a speaker, and it all kinds of goes together for me. So it was, so far, it all works.
Okay, now this is going to be nutty. I also really love your dad's novels, James Lee Burke. Uh-huh. And I have to ask you this. I'm in a room with you. Do you guys ever sit on the couch and just talk about murder? I have to ask you that.
Basically, that's my childhood, is we would sit on the couch and talk about murder. It's very funny to me because I'll have friends. My friends here now have kids who are, you know, kind of in that 8 to 13-year-old range. And they'll kind of protect their kids from my books, that they're too dark or something, or not take them to my Powell's readings because I'm talking about murder. And I'm like, wow, my parents had no problem talking about murder with me when I was a little kid. I actually grew up in Wichita, Kansas, and there was a serial killer who was, speaking of serial killers, I said they were Florida and Pacific Northwest, but there was one in Kansas who called himself BTK, which stood for bind, torture, and kill. That is not a good thing to hear when you're 11 years old. And my parents not only told me that that was happening, I mean, it was unavoidable to know that it was happening, but we would sit around and like have theories about what kind of person he'd be and how he was getting away with it and what the police should be doing that they weren't doing. So he also has a complete obsession with crime. We're both kind of obsessed with crime. So.
All right. So just to follow up on that, who was the touchstone in your life? Who shaped your careers the most?
Wow. That's very hard to say. You know, my brother was a lawyer, and I think that part of me went to law school, perhaps because I kind of saw the work he was doing. But in terms of writing, I think it makes a big difference that my mother was a school librarian and my father was a writer, or is a writer, and was a writer then. And we were surrounded by books. I couldn't imagine a world without books. And my mother would take me to the library every weekend to get a stack of books from the public library. And I realize in retrospect, it was a good way to get me out of the house so that my dad could write. It was free. We'd be there for hours. But I'm sure they didn't realize that that setup at the time was not only helping my father create work, it was turning me into the writer I've become, right? Because that's what we would do all day, is pick out books together. And then I would take them home and read them during the week, and then we'd bring them back and start again. So I really, my parents, I think, sort of shaped that. I think my experience at the district attorney's office gave me something to write about. I didn't set out to be a writer, amazingly.
All right. And now I want to ask you, what are you working on next, and talk about that exciting collaboration?
Yes. So I've got two things going right now. As you mentioned, I collaborate. Just started working on a series with Mary Higgins Clark, which every time I say that sentence, I have to kind of pinch myself. Yes, I co-author with Mary Higgins Clark. And we've just finished or just published the second book in a series that we're writing together. And that book's called All Dressed in White, and we're working on the next one now. And then I'm also working on my next series book. I have a series set in New York about a detective named Ellie Hatcher, and I'm working on the sixth book in that series. I'm excited about that. It takes her back to Kansas. She grew up in Kansas like me, and she has to go back to Kansas to deal with something kind of personal. So I'm interested, and I'm happy with that book right now. So,
all right. Well, Mary, I'm sorry. I almost called you Mary Higgins Clark. All right.
We jokingly refer to me now as Alifair Higgins Clark.
Alifair Burke, I want to thank you again for coming down to the KABU building and chatting with us today.
Thank you. It's so great to be back here. I appreciate it.
And I'm Lisa Loving for Between the Covers.
KABU Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Portland Eco Film Festival series at the Hollywood Theater. The film this month is Sunu, screening Thursday, February 11th at 7:30 p.m. in its U.S. premiere. Seen through the eyes of small, midsize, and large Mexican maize producers, Sunu knits together different stories from a threatened rural world. Sun Lu reveals how maize and everything it gives life to could be lost forever, and how we all could lose the capability to make important choices unless we act soon. Edna Vasquez will perform before the film. Again, that's the U.S. premiere of Sun Lu as part of the Portland Eco Film Festival on Thursday, February 11th, 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film screening of Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Warrior tells the true story of Leonard Peltier, the American Indian leader locked away for life in Leavenworth Penitentiary. Warrior takes us back to the violent confrontations at Pine Ridge and Wounded Knee in the 70s, and through Peltier's harrowing odyssey through the American justice system. Leonard's son, Chauncey Peltier, will hold a Q&A after the film. Again, that's Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.